There we are. I think I've got them. I don't know why the light is messing about this morning. Hello, everybody. Are you okay? Hello. Are you having a nice morning? It's quite a while since we met, isn't it? 3 weeks. Yeah. I honestly don't know what's happened to the light. There we are. It's usually better. Okay. What we're doing is tying up what you've been working with. Or this the area you've been working with, which is the solar plexus, and tying that up with the actual what it represents, what it means, and giving the background to the digestive system and being influenced by the autogenic practice. Interesting thing about that is that when the physiologists were doing research on the physiology of the body, like Claude Bernard in the 18th, end of the 18th century, no, 19th century, came up with homeostasis, and I'm sure you know what that means. He came up with the understanding of homeostasis, which is how all the systems in the body have a regulatory system to come back. Yes, Jane?
Well,
Jane?
I'm so sorry, Anne. You're breaking
Jane,
up
do you want to say something?
You're breaking
Sorry.
up a lot. It
Oh,
might be
oh
better
dear.
if you switched off your video and then we can hear you. Could we do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Is that okay? Is that
Yes,
better?
that's fine. Yes, it is. Yes,
Oh,
thank
it's
you.
just so annoying. I'm so
Yeah.
sorry, but I think it's my broadband supply, which is does it. So you can hear me. So
Yes,
okay, jolly
a
good.
lot
So
better.
what I was saying was the digestive system is very much influenced by autogenic practice, and this was historically, this was the great physiologist Claude Bernard, who worked at the end of the 19th century and coined the term homeostasis. And let's face it, the work that we are doing here is very much targeted on homeostasis, which is the ability for the body to bring back into regulation all the different systems, the blood pressure, the pulse rate, and all of those. So that was Claude Bernard. But in the beginning of the 20th century, a man called Walter Cannon just was working particularly on the physiology, which is the function of the digestive tract. And he did experiments, and I think this was on, I believe this was on birds, or I don't know why it was, but anyway, it was birds. And he actually exposed them to a shock. Don't know quite what sort of shock, but some sort of physiological shock. And in so doing, the alimentary system or the digestive system shut down completely. So there we are. Our digestive system is very much influenced by what's going on around. This is why it's very much influenced by the autogenic practice. And I hope that you will find, as you're teaching people, that you have people giving messages and feedback that actually supports the fact that the digestive system is very much influenced. So to start from the beginning, let's talk about the structure and then the function and then the malfunction, which actually will give you this one. So the digestive system, my solar plexus is warm. Now, that actually, the solar plexus and the sighting of it does actually refer to a specific place in your body, which is in the upper abdomen. And the solar plexus is actually really is an anatomical and physiological place in the body. It's called the celiac plexus, and it's below the diaphragm, and it's the actual little knot of nervous tissue, a bit like the Clapham junction of the nervous tissue, where impulses go. And that actually influences all the digestive organs. So the celiac plexus, also known as my solar plexus, is what we're basing on, and that is influencing the physiology and the action of the abdomen, of the digestive organs. So let's then start. The digestive system is known as the gastrointestinal tract, the alimentary system, and the gut. So it's got several names. And in actual fact, it's you can hear me. Can you hear me okay?
Yes,
Oh,
we
good. Okay.
can.
Good, good,
Very
good, good.
good.
It's one long tube, one long muscular tube, and it's very, very long. And this muscular tube is has, if it's a muscular tube, then obviously the wall of this tube is made of muscle, which can contract and relax, and it's also lined. It's lined with mucous membrane, which is a membrane that secretes. The tube is, and it's it which secretes digestive juices, and the activity of the muscle wall, which is the contracting of the muscle of the muscle wall, is called peristalsis. And peristalsis is the movement of the muscle wall which propels the food along from in the mouth to ending up being evacuated from the anus. So the digestion is one long passage from your mouth through to your anus and actual for evacuation. So it's another of those miraculous systems in the body. And so the digestive tract is made up of, first of all, the mouth. So everything starts in the mouth. So it starts with what you put in your mouth. So what have we got in the mouth? So whatever you put into your mouth, you've got teeth, you've got a tongue, we've got saliva, and we've got a muscular wall around there to swallow. So your food goes into your mouth, and the idea is that you masticate, you chew it, and in so doing, you improve and enlarge the surface area of the food. So if you put a lump in and swallow that, it's very indigestible. You have to chew it, which actually increases the surface area. And on that surface area can actually be worked on by the first digestive juice or digestive secretion, which is called ptyalin, which is Ptyalin. And this actually is secreted in your salivary glands, which are the parotid under your ear and the submandibular ones under your chin. And when you eat, they produce saliva, and the saliva goes into your mouth and acts on the food in your mouth. It only begins to digest starch, not protein or fiber or fat. So that's why when you put a sweet in your mouth and you suck it, eventually it will disappear to nothing. And that's because it's made of sugar. And the ptyalin, the first digestive juice which is in your mouth, acts on sugar. So starting in the mouth, you taking your mouthful, you actually chew it, increase the surface area. The salivary glands have produced saliva, which are beginning to act on the food. And can you hear me? Oh, it's gone. Can you hear me? Oh.
You did go a little bit, but you've come back just as you're
Yes,
summarizing. So
so
we're
sorry.
no, we're
Yes,
fine, Anne. You were summarizing, so we didn't lose you. Okay.
okay. So that's the start. So let's look at the actual what the digestive tract is made of. So the mouth, we've got the teeth, we've got the tongue, we've got the secretion of saliva digesting starch for actually chewing. So the next bit is back at the back of your throat, which is called the oropharynx. And then we've got gullet. And this is a transit tube. It's had no digestive function whatsoever. It's just you swallow down your throat, it's gone.
It's very
No,
difficult.
you can't hear. No.
We can hear now. We couldn't a moment ago.
I don't know whether should I continue or should we leave it?
What do you think, Donna? We could readjust the timetables, make it a different.
I don't know. This, I mean, it, this, why this is happening now, I just don't know.
No.
What
Donna,
if
you're
I,
muted.
what if I get rid of a few more people and just have Sebastian and here and there to see if that works, which is
Okay.
less of a load.
Yes.
It's just worth trying.
That's a good idea, just to remove the pictures.
Yeah,
We could
of.
also just all have our cameras off and see if that helped too.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe.
That's probably the easiest.
You see, already it's easier with just three pictures. So now I've got Patricia.
I'll put my camera off too.
Well, now how we should talk a little bit, shouldn't we? Just to see. Can you hear us, Anne?
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Right, let's get going
Let
before the gremlins get there again.
Yes, absolutely.
So we've got to swallowing down the esophagus, which, as I said, is just a delivery tube. It's like any sort of delivery. The stuff goes in, delivery, and out at the other end, and that then goes through to the stomach, and that goes through a hole. I'll call it a hole in the diaphragm. So now we're going into the abdominal cavity, and that hole in the diaphragm is held by tightly by a sphincter, which if it laxes, you get reflux of acid. So the stomach is the store bag. It's something where the food goes down. You know, you could not have eaten for 10 hours, and it's quite small. You could go and have a seven-course meal, and it's absolutely enormous to actually be able to hold all that food. So it has enormous capacity to store. At the same time, the stomach has a particular lining. It secretes pepsin, which begins to digest protein, and very strong hydrochloric acid. So that's a fairly potent concoction. And the stomach has to have be lined with cells, mucous membrane, that have an inherent innate protection against digesting themselves. And that's an important point to keep in mind when you have people with reflux and people who have ulcers. Not many people with ulcers these days, but in the old days, there certainly were. And it begins the digestion in the stomach of protein. It also secretes the intrinsic factor for B12 absorption. And I don't know if you know anything about the B system of vitamins, but B12 is necessary for making good red healthy blood cells. So there we are, continuing our journey down through this incredible muscular tube, specialized in all these different places. You next go to the duodenum, which is the first part of what's called the small intestine. And that place takes the early digested food from the stomach and pours onto it pancreatic enzymes, which begin to begin to digest fats. It also secretes bile and bicarbonate to neutralize acid. So there's the most incredible, wonderful biochemistry going on here, as this food, this food that you ate, is being acted upon by all these things. So we've got to the duodenum, which is the first part of the small intestine and the first part from food leaving the stomach, and you get to what we call the small intestine, which is a very long tube. I believe, if I remember facts and figures, some of which one can, I think it's 32 feet long, which is very long. It's also called the jejunum or the ileum. And here, this is concerned with absorption of the digested food. So what the ileum does is actually take in what is the right sort of thing. It has a very, very important filtration system, where it is supposed not to allow absorption of things that you don't want, but only to absorb things that are beneficial to you, which are the building blocks of being able to keep alive and replace cells. So the duodenum is a very, very long part of the intestine. Is about absorbed through all the way. The food has had all the goodness inside the bowel. So then you reach the colon, what's called the large bowel. And at the point where the small intestine meets the large intestine, you have a little redundant piece of bowel, which evolutionarily nobody can understand why, called the appendix, which has no digestive function whatsoever. But as you well know, causes in perhaps, I don't know, 50, 60, 70%, I don't know what the percentage is, gets acutely inflamed and end up in hospital having to have it removed. So that can be a nuisance, and it's one of the small bits of the of wonder that you can quite understand why we've still got it. Maybe in evolutionary terms, it's quite small, it will actually disappear. I must say, when I had a colonoscopy, they couldn't find my appendix, and I thought, did I have an appendix out? I did. I had my tonsils out, but I didn't. So that was a bit of a mystery. I'm still thinking about that one. So we've got the colon. Now, in the colon, it has no digestive function whatsoever. So the food that you put in through the mouth, it's going through this wonderful factory of digestion. You get to the colon, it's the waste matter. But it's at that point, it's very fluid. And so in its passage through the colon, the large bowel, all that is done is reabsorption of water, so that it reaches the rectum, which is getting towards the very last bit of this long muscular tube. And the rectum stores the waste matter ready for evacuation, or in colloquial terms, doing a poo, and actually eventually gives you the feeling in the anus that you want to evacuate, or you want to go and do a poo. And so at the anus, you have a sphincter, and then you actually eliminate the waste matter, or have a good poo, we hope. So that's the story of the food that you put in your mouth. So we talked about just putting a sweet in your mouth. There's nothing that comes out the other end. If we actually talk about having perhaps a curry where you have lots of fiber and protein and so on and so forth, they've all that's useful has been digested, broken down, absorbed, or excreted. And I think that's an incredible story. Mm. It really is an incredible story. It's almost romantic that's going on. So the digestion, your digestion, is under voluntary and involuntary control. And one of the things to know, which I know you'll all be aware of, is that the way of there's a one-way system. Peristalsis, the muscular working of the tube, is a one-way system only, except when your stomach decides that it's got something in there that isn't going to do you any good. And the miracle of the body is it, you vomit it up. So you have anti-peristalsis, and I'm sure we have all been aware of that. So on the whole, it's the stomach and all these wonders of physiology is saying that's poison, that's this, that's that, that's the other, and gets rid of it, including infections. So that's another part of this amazing story. So there we are. We've got the food going in and the waste matter leaving. So let's look at this point, let's look at the effect of the autogenic practice on digestion. So sympathetic activity reduces appetite. So what are we talking about there? We're talking about the fact that when we're in shock or hyper active or having, on the whole, we don't secrete saliva. And in fact, a typical thing is, you know, when one is giving a presentation or something like that, your mouth goes dry. And the reason for this is that when you're in a state of high arousal and the need perhaps for action or flight or something like that, you don't need to be digesting food. You actually want to be able to access all the activity and action parts mentally and physically that you need to deal with the situation. However, of course, we know that a lot of the sympathetic activity is what we would call stress, and you can have that, and the activity is reduced anyway. And I'm sure that you will be able to remember times when you've had no appetite at all, when you've been in a state perhaps of stress or high activity, and particularly sometimes periods of prolonged stress, weight loss. I can remember having a time of incredible stress when you know, things just shut down. And I think I lost about 8 pounds in a week, which of course, always through our lives, we're always trying to keep our weight down, which was the only good thing about it. But it actually, just as Walter Cannon did, he found that the digestion just stops. So the secretions stop, peristalsis stops. Now, when you get into the rest and renewal and repair thing, you've obviously got the opposite. You've got the stimulation of secretions, the mouth waters, and here we get to the well-known parts, the well-known experiences of the people who are yourself and the people who are learning autogenic practice, is that they start to actually produce saliva, their mouth waters. I'm sure you've all done that, haven't you? You say yes, yes.
Yes,
I can hear you.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, yes,
yes,
yes, yes, yes, yes. And also, you've got it stimulates the peristalsis in your tummy, and we know that you can have tummy rumbling, and also an improved bowel action. So altogether, a very, very useful and helpful effect on your digestive tract. And the thing about the digestive tract, unlike the heart, for instance, the skin is very wide, has a lot of skin that has a lot of symptoms. The musculoskeletal system has an awful lot of tissue and a lot of symptoms. The heart, pretty direct there. The lungs, something. But when you've got something as active and as much tissue as the digestive tract, you're bound to have the place for a lot of symptoms. And so be it. So let's have a look at the conditions that you're likely to meet with. So first of all, I think to remember that actually the autogenic practice has, I think I could say universally, a beneficial get to one thing about conditions where you've got to be a little bit careful with someone just who's probably possibly got something where they've got sort of heartburn or something like this, or the bowel isn't working very well. This can have a very, very positive effect. I'm not sure whether people particularly come to do autogenic training because of their digestive tract, but they might, depending on what the problem is. So if we're looking at conditions of the digestive tract, I think at this point I'll just say, does anybody want to say anything about the structure and the function, about their own personal experience or anything? Anybody want to say anything?
Anybody want to say anything?
Yeah.
Yes, please, Anne. It's
Yeah.
Bev.
Yes, hello.
Yes, it's written about, and you've talked about the increase in saliva
Yeah.
during the autogenic process or when people are not in a stress response. Is there other mucus that's produced as well, other than saliva?
Well, the whole of the digestive tract is actually joining in. It's just that you're not so aware of your stomach producing its secretions or and it's so all of the digestion, one way and another, the whole lot is going on all the time to a
Yeah.
greater or lesser extent. What happens, and it's not particularly that saliva is the only one, but it's the one that you can become aware of, and sometimes so much so that your mouth just completely waters. And we know that there are stories and perhaps experience of people having to have a handkerchief there because they dribble so much. But that is just saliva. You can take it that all the other secretions are going on as well or improved. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and I
Yeah.
was also wondering about, say, runny nose or anything that is that something separate?
Quite separate.
Yeah,
Yes,
okay.
quite
Thanks
separate, quite
for
separate.
clarifying
That
that.
belongs to the respiratory system. But the thing is that all of these systems are interrelated, and we all have idiosyncratic parts of us where one thing can happen and you think, well, it shouldn't happen, it only happens to me. So if someone's nose runs at the same time as doing a practice, so be it. But that's not part of digestion.
No.
That's part of the nasal secretions. That's another secretion. But nothing. I mean, have you had experience of that, Bev?
Yeah, I think when I was learning, I had the saliva response, but I also noticed that I had a lot of kind of mucus or whatever liquid in my nose as well. And I don't know if that was something to do with AT or not.
Well, I don't either. It could be, it
No.
couldn't be. I think I've actually, on a personal note, I've noticed, which is really quite bizarre recently, that when I go to do a poo, my nose runs. Now, I can't explain that, but these things happen. These
Yeah.
things just decide to happen. But it's not actually, the secretion is not part of the digestion system. It's not a digestive secretion. It's a nasal secretion. And probably, if you analyzed it, it's just a saline solution with mucus.
Yeah.
Whereas your saliva has got this digestive juice, this digestive substance, ptyalin, spelt PTYALIN, ptyalin, with a silent E. has that. The nasal secretions don't have that in. They just it's sort of salt and water and mucus, I think, isn't it? Yes. Okay. So things happen. Things happen.
Thank you, Anne.
Yes. Anybody else want to say anything about the
Yes,
actual function? Yes,
I
Sebastian.
will have a question, Anne. Do you know there are a lot of clients or individuals who normally fast? I would like to know whether there is a contraindication with regards of the autogenic exercise. For example, if I do practice intermittent fasting, there may be some sort of contraindication, like some sort of exercises or formulas that I would not be indicated to do them, or would you let me
Well,
know?
this isn't something I've studied, but off the top of my head, I don't see any contraindication to doing an autogenic practice. My first thoughts are that fasting is a bit of a stress. It's meant to be a bit of a stress on the
No.
systems anyway. So, and if you're fasting, you won't be secreting too much. But so if you actually relieve the stress of the condition, I think it would be a good thing. My feeling, as far as I know, my understanding, is that it would be a good thing for the digestive tract rather than not a good thing, because it would keep the secretions going, and so on. So I think that's the best I can do, Sebastian. I don't think it would be harmful, and it could be beneficial.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I mean, you might have a you might feel differently. I mean, do you fast?
I do sometimes. Yeah, I'm trying to skip a meal, but anyway, that has nothing to do with autogenics. But I was wondering whether, for example, if I'm fasting the whole day, shall I refrain from certain exercises or not? Okay.
I don't
Anyway,
see
I've got
any
your.
reason to do. I don't see any reason to do that. And in fact, I would say I see a reason to do it more than not.
It's something personal. Anyway, thank you
Because
very
the
much.
yes, it is, would be a something of a challenge, if not a stress, a challenge to the to all the systems, particularly the digestive system, because that's the one that's being affected by fasting. It would be a challenge, and this might be something that supports the system while it's being challenged.
I
That would be
see.
my thinking.
Thank you. Thank you very much,
Okay.
Anne.
Anything else? Anybody want to say anything else about the function of the or the what we've just gone through? Anybody else want to say anything? Right. Okay. So let's look on to the conditions of the digestive tract that and all of these you're likely to meet. Well, pretty well all of them you're likely to meet, and people may or may not have come to see you about this, but you should bear in mind that whatever they've come to see you about, that the exercises will be, and I'm going to say, benefiting your the digestion, which is a good thing to think. So let's look at the disorders of function, which is rather, this is not specifically a disease as such, an identifier, but it's something where the digestion isn't working properly. And I think I've written on my notes, functionally, we've got what's commonly known as indigestion, whatever people are describing there, which is usually a discomfort or a pain, acid reflux, which people describe in that way, that they've got acidity and that would cause pain, irritable bowel syndrome, and constipation. Now, indigestion, acid reflux are fairly similar. They're, on the whole, they're describing the fact that some of the contents of the stomach have gone backwards up the gullet. There's a weakness in the hole where the gullet goes through the diaphragm, which is often the case. Maybe there's too much pressure in the abdomen, which is pushing on the stomach, to go to push against the hole in the diaphragm. Maybe there's a weakness. So what it actually means is that some of the contents of the stomach that is there digesting food that has come down through the esophagus, it's secreting pepsin and concentrated hydrochloric acid. So pepsin and hydrochloric acid are very, very powerful enzymes, enzymes and acid that act on the food. And they, you know, as I said before, the stomach has very special cells, mucous membrane lining it, which have an inherent protection against digesting itself. So what happens if a bit of this very concentrated digestive juice and a bit of the food it's digesting is pushed back up the gullet, which does not have any protection whatsoever because it's not a digestive organ? It actually, the lining of the esophagus or the mucous membrane does not like this at all. And so it becomes inflamed or even ulcerated. So that's what's happening there. So I think indigestion and acid reflux are around that area. Indigestion is also, I'll get on to peptic ulcer in a bit, but IBS, now there's one that undoubtedly you will come across, irritable bowel syndrome. So if you look at those words, irritable, oh dear, bowel syndrome, collection of things. So what you've got here is that muscular tube, which is working away, digesting, and then actually producing the waste material. It actually isn't working smoothly. It has areas that doesn't like to work properly. And this, I think, is particularly in the large bowel or the colon. And so you get symptoms. And because there's such a lot of tissue in the digestive system, you can have a lot of symptoms. And that means that you've got painful peristalsis, you've got poor digestion, you've got irregular bowel, nothing's working well. And I think this is probably a more modern disease, and I think it's probably more commonly in women, in female, in girls, in women, which one can have a think about. And one of the things I think is that this is a lot to do with digestion, but I think it can be quite a lot to do with the fact that we rush around. And in the morning, there is what's called a gastrocolic reflex, which is when you have a hot drink in the morning or something to drink or something to eat, it actually stimulates the bowel to empty. And that's quite a healthy thing. And I think sometimes, particularly with young people, they rush into tight clothes, don't have breakfast, and rush off, and don't give time for the gastrocolic reflex. Now that's a very simplistic thing, because there's lots and lots and lots of research on irritable bowel syndrome, about different food things, the fermented polysaccharides and monosaccharides and all the rest of it, and it can get very complicated about that, about dietary. But what does happen, I think, with people with IBS, first of all, they suffer big time, and secondly, they are often worried about what they eat and what they don't eat. So I think there's quite a lot of anxiety, well, there is a lot of anxiety, discomfort and disquiet about having this. And although it's a functional disorder and it's not actually a disease as such, as the other ones we're going to talk about, is actually absolutely miserable and can be very severe. So I think you will come across people, clients, who have got IBS. It might be that they come to you because of that, or they come to you because they've got anxiety about eating, which is as a result of having an irritable bowel or an eating problem. I think you can be quite confident that regular autogenic practice will actually have a positive effect on the function of the digestive system, and particularly the function of the bowel. In there is constipation, which is in IBS, you've often got a mixture of diarrhea and constipation, and it's a miserable condition, with lots of pain, lots of discomfort, and lots of misery. So that's what we call functional, which is a disorder of function. So then we're going to look at the disorders which you have in the digestive processes. So I put excess secretions. In other words, there's too much secretion going on, particularly in the stomach, and you've got peptic or duodenal ulcer, or you've got reduced secretions. It is fairly rare thing called Sjögren's syndrome, where you have loss of saliva and also dry eyes and a sort of general drying up. It's an autoimmune condition, general drying up. I think you might. I had someone with Sjögren's system at the hospital came to me. It's a very, very unpleasant condition where they've got no saliva in the mouth. She's got a permanently dry mouth. I'm just trying to remember what happened. I think the success, as if you could call it success, or the positive thing, was really overall, rather than particularly in her mouth. But it was a good suggestion to do that, because we know that actually increasing saliva, I mean, saliva is increased. I don't think you have someone coming to see you with that. But peptic ulcer, duodenal ulcer, now they were, when I was first qualified in the 60s, they were like heart attacks. They were very common and a bit of a scourge. And the peptic ulcer was where a part of the lining of the stomach was ulcerated, and a duodenal ulcer was an area of the mucosa in the duodenum, which is ulcerated. And they are terribly painful. They are, or were, or are dangerous. They could bleed. If this required, then operation, removing half the stomach. In my lifetime as a practitioner, reduced the secretion of pepsin, and actually almost made peptic ulcers obsolete. And after that, more recently, well, it's not recent actually, because it's probably 30 years, they discovered that there was a bacteria, Helicobacter, that was in people, antibiotics. So there has been a lot of treatment of ulcers, rather than two things. If the classic thing in the old days was that the high-powered executive would get a duodenal ulcer because of worry, which produced, and would be having, and was put onto a medical ward for 6 weeks on milk, white fish and milk, and would be sitting there with his briefcase working away. So that was an old sort of an old image of what it was, to get rid of a duodenum ulcer. But that does, I don't think that happens now, which is good. But the ulcers were excess secretions and breakdown of the mucous membrane. But now we have medication, to actually stop that. Another problem in the this is in the small bowel, the area of the bowel where you absorb is malabsorption, which means not good absorption. So you've got the intolerances, lactose intolerance and celiac disease to gluten, which is the protein, which is a sugar, which is in milk. So what you have is an intolerance and an inability to digest these parts in the small bowel, which causes problems, health problems and digestive problems. And what you have to do in terms of treating those is avoid them altogether, which is called gluten-free or lactose-free. And I think these days there's such a lot written and said about diets and what you should and shouldn't eat and intolerances and allergies and food allergies. There's an awful lot written about it. And you have to be careful what people understand about this, that they've got an allergy or an intolerance and they lead their life around this, which may or may not have been proven or may be something that is a bit not quite proven. But these digestive problems cause great disquiet and discomfort and anxiety. And to some extent, they impair the pleasure of eating. And that is quite a stressful thing to have. So the autogenic practice is always something that can actually deal or can help that stress and that anxiety of living with such a condition. The other conditions in the bowel are Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Crohn's disease is, and they're thought to be just the same process but in different parts. Crohn's disease is an inflammatory condition of the small bowel, and ulcerative colitis is an inflammatory condition in the large bowel. And these are potentially serious and can be life-threatening conditions. In Crohn's disease, they cause ulceration, they cause fistulas, they cause things where the fistula then causes a fibrosis, and you have an area in the abdomen which has really glued itself together. Very painful, very debilitating. And ulcerative colitis is the same sort of condition in the large bowel, where you have areas of inflammation which can actually perforate and certainly can bleed. So some quite unpleasant things going on. In terms of doing, and then the last thing is, I just want to say, malignancy. So cancer can occur at any site in the digestive tract. So starting in the mouth, in the gullet, in the stomach, in the intestine, in the bowel, and I think we know there's a very high profile of bowel cancer, and many attempts to actually to prevent this and to get it early. So there is a lot going on in the alimentary tract. A lot of symptoms, a lot of possibilities, and also a lot of possibilities for the autogenic training. The inflammatory ones, the celiac disease, the ulcerative colitis, the actual stress of having a chronic condition. There isn't a reason not to do the autogenic training, because at that point you're dealing with someone who has got an illness which is actually affecting their life. There was a thing where before we had all the treatments for peptic ulcer, duodenal ulcer, there were guidelines that you shouldn't actually teach autogenic training because it would actually increase the secretions. But now we have medication that actually deals with that. So that would be something we would consider. We possibly would not treat someone who has active symptoms, but treating someone who has a history is probably absolutely okay. So malignancy, I've had obviously had quite a few people who have bowel cancer, as we know, is not an uncommon malignancy. There's absolutely no reason not to teach autogenic training to deal with the overall effect of dealing with and having a malignant thing, which and all the treatments and the colonoscopies and the tensions, and that as with any living with any malignancy can be very helpful. And then you've got, as a sort of last thing on the digestive tract, you've got food allergies and intolerances. Now, people tend to say allergy where it might be an intolerance. Obviously, there are very specific and dangerous food allergies which that your client would know about. But intolerances, sometimes people say they're allergies and they're just they shouldn't eat as much of that, or they shouldn't eat that at all. And people can be aware of what actually causes that. And there are programs where people go on elimination diets and so on and so forth. So these may well crop up. And I think the best bet is to explore, if someone has got food allergies, explore the background to that, explore what it means to them, explore the symptoms, and sort of make your mind up about, because if you have food allergies or intolerances, you're very anxious about what you eat. And so that can certainly help on that. So perhaps just a last couple of things. The digestive tract in health produces sensations and awareness of its action. So we know that. We can feel tummy rumblings, and we can actually sort of feel when we eat something that the digestive tract is working away. So in health, we have an awareness. In disease, the symptoms can be extreme, and this can lead to much dietary anxiety. As I've said, we've got IBS, constipation, and all the other problems in the digestive tract. So I think the dietary anxiety is a big thing. And I've got that eating disorders are not gastrointestinal conditions, but behavior disorders. However, anorexia and bulimia can cause damage to the digestive tract because of vomiting up acid and causing inflammation in the upper part of the digestive tract. So if you're constantly vomiting up acid and highly acid food, it isn't going to do your upper digestive tract much good. So I've written that AT has a great potential for improving the function of the digestive tract and improving attitudes towards eating. And the potential of floating exercises and personal affirmations can be especially helpful. They nearly time for lunch. Has anybody gone through it rather quickly? But here we are.
Anne.
Yeah.
I want to thank you so much. We did lose bits, but you know what? There's something in the ether which helped us because you were summarizing. We could catch up so easily. I don't think we lost you, but I do think you've done a fantastic job just talking to us as blank screens. You've done absolutely brilliantly, and I want to thank you. Fascinating.
Well, I don't think it made much difference, does it, that I wasn't on the screen. Did you hear that?
Yes, we did hear that, yes, but we were not on this.
It didn't make a great deal of difference that I wasn't there. And it didn't make a great deal of difference that you weren't there, because once you get into something, I just focused on what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
But if there were questions, I'd like to have, let's have some questions from anybody, or some comments about their own digestive tract or whatever.
We are getting on to lunchtime, funnily enough.
Let's leave it and have some lunch. I'm sure you're ready for it.
I will make one comment, which was a client very recently was told by her fiancé, a partner rather, that when they went for dinner, as they left the restaurant, he said, "Did you realise that you looked at the menu and you ordered your food in a normal way, instead of calling the waiter over, asking what was in each individual item? It didn't seem like you cared anymore." And she hadn't even realised that that's what she had done.
That's fantastic.
It was amazing.
That illustrates what I'm not only saying. People have all sorts of anxieties and all sorts of mal sort of thoughts about the diet and the digestion, some of which are healthy and some aren't. And I think the autogenic practice can certainly help with that. Okay, enjoy it.
Anne, may I ask a quick question?
Yes, of course.
In the theory notes for abdominal warmth, one of the relative contraindications is about diabetic clients with unstable diabetes. And the reason I'm asking this question is I had a friend who expressed an interest, and she said, you know, that her diabetes wasn't very good. And I don't know really anything about it. I just wondered what that point might refer to in our theory notes, if you can help with that.
Yes, if you look at the notes, we've got that in the duodenum, the pancreas secretes pancreatic enzymes, which are to do with the digestion of fats, particularly, and you've got bile. So the pancreas, the islets of Langerhans produce insulin. So when we're talking about diabetes, it's actually, I should have mentioned that, it's actually known, understood, that because the autogenic practice enhances the parasympathetic, the digestion aspect of us, but it is likely that it actually enhances the pancreatic. If the pancreas is still able to produce insulin, which is the case with type 2 diabetes, with type 1 diabetes, this might not be the case, although it's not known whether someone with type 1, where the pancreas is functionally, the pancreas has been completely wiped out, absolutely, totally, and completely, or almost completely. So there is potential for the pancreas to improve and secrete some more insulin. Now, that's important if you have got someone who has is on injections for diabetic control. And I think that being the case, you would want to find out as much as possible. I mean, the use of insulin and the drivers and all the rest is, it makes it unusual that the client doesn't know absolutely everything about their diabetic control and what they can eat. But there is every reason to say that there is a theoretical possibility that the pancreas can improve the secretion of insulin. Now, if you are actually controlling your diabetes with a once or twice daily or whatever, I mean, in years past, it used to be every 6 months, injection of insulin. As I say, things are quite sophisticated these days. But if you have got a schedule of injectable insulin to actually, if your pancreas decides to wake up a bit and produce some more insulin, then the theoretical or the possibility is that you don't need so much insulin. And I remember that, and I'm not sure of the actual insulins now. I know that since I was practicing, they've changed quite a lot. But there are the long-acting ones. And the thing was, the long-acting one given at night and the pancreas producing more insulin could actually destabilize that. So let's talk theoretically. If you were going to teach someone AT, you would ask them to actually, you want to know what the situation with their diabetes was now, what they were doing, what the care and attention was. You would explain that there is a possibility that they would need less insulin, and you would explore this and perhaps get them to do more readings. I think you would have to feel confident about that. But if it was type 2 diabetes, that's different. In type 2 diabetes, the pancreas is still producing insulin, but not quite as much. And now people have medication and dietary regulation to deal with that. And certainly the AT can be very helpful there if you think the pancreas is still secreting, and this is going to give it some support and perhaps enhance the production of insulin, which, again, if they are monitoring their diabetes as they should be, then that would be able to just look at that. They could look at it day by day and see if it's changing, and then discuss that or discuss it with their diabetic control person. I mean, the thing is, the AT does have potential for actually enhancing the production of insulin. Just trying to remember, I remember having people, and I think it was actually upping their own screening. I mean, people have pens now to do their blood glucose, and it's not a great performance now having to do a pee and go on. So I think it has, theoretically and in real terms, physiologically, it can increase the secretion of insulin. And there we are. So then you would use that carefully with your client.
Thank you. And I'm really sorry. I'm going to say now we must end our session. We're going to lose Pia soon because you won't have electricity. So I'm thinking let's do our next session, which is half an hour after lunch. Let's do it now so that Pia doesn't have to miss that one. So Anne, Thank you so much.
I'll see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow. Absolutely. Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that very much.
Thank you, Anne. Very, bye. Very, bye very interesting.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you.
Is that all right? Would you think that that might be a good idea? Because the next little half hour session would take us up to 2:30, which then Pia would miss. But if we did it now, she's missing less this afternoon.
Oh, that would be great.
We've already looked at the dream formula. This is a tiny little bit. Is that okay? Then we'll have lunch and the dog can go for the walk. Is that all right, Bev?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay. Because that was absolutely fascinating. And I'll give you the correct spelling for Crohn's disease a bit later. You might have to ask me. Okay.
I wonder, Jane, could we have a very quick wee break? Is that all right?
Oh, yes. Go on. Go to the loo. I'll do the same. Good idea.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Pia.
Hello.
Are you feeling okay, Bev?
Yeah, so much better. Thank you.
You're over the
tonsillitis. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, what's the name of your area, your city that was flooded?
Oh, Lismore.
Lismore. And whereabouts is that in Australia?
Yeah, it's up near the Queensland border. Oh. Yeah, the whole area up here was unprecedented floods that we had last year. I nearly lost my house, and yeah, it was pretty bad. Really, really shocking.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. It sounds really quite catastrophic.
Oh. Well, it was. Yeah, and there's still people in this area that lives in tent and in their cars. It's just there's no housing for them. 30,000 people. Without houses, really bad.
Yeah,
like the roads has been so bad for a long time because they all disappeared, you know. So yeah, nature is very powerful. That's
absolutely
for sure.
Yes,
very
yes.
Very powerful.
Yes.
Scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Are you okay to do this? It just occurred to me, this is such a small little bit, we might as well clear it. Now, I sent you one curious piece of paper.
Yes.
Are you? Okay. So this is a summary, and we can just use this. We'll have no other notes. I might dig out some old notes for you and send them. We don't have to worry about this, but this is the origins of Luther's theory, a genetic constellation of the authentic self, and showing possibilities. Of course, I should have a whiteboard or share the screen. This is the idea of a genetically concordant functioning of one cell. And I like to think of this, if we think of this as a person, It's a bit easier to relate to than a cell. So we've got the nucleus in the beginning. And then, of course, all the things that go out of that and all of sort of talents and leanings and abilities and general functioning, sometimes they're going to clash. Sometimes they're going to clash really badly. But this is assuming that the possibilities of each person on these arrows is actually happening with that broad diagram. So the person is probably functioning according to their natural leanings, their natural
sorry to interrupt, but for me it doesn't make sense. What the letters represent?
Nothing very much. I mean, well, if you go into his article about this is so complicated, I can't understand it. So we won't worry about the letters. Thank you, Sebastian. It's just let's go into another one and see if we can find any correlation. That looks different, doesn't it? It doesn't look so harmonious. There's a bit of where the nucleus is being pulled out in a direction it doesn't really want to go. If you look at H, so the letters are just names. So H is, it's all being pulled in there from the outer circle, which is genetic concordance and harmony. Okay, we haven't got an outer circle here, but that jagged edge is I think it's trying to function and it's not. Let's put an example in there. I wonder which of those letters we might say might be the musician who is really, really functioning as a musician. But this is really, I don't want you to worry about this. You're not going to get tested on it. I'm glad. I mean, I'm looking at A there, and also in the upper picture as well, that actually that person is maybe fulfilling their potential, because A is, it represents music, shall we say, just as an example, and that person is doing it. Could we find one which is less concordant? Those bottom pictures are really quite disturbed when you look at them. We've still got the letters. What have we got? I'm looking in a mirror fashion, so I don't know which of those two diagrams is yours. Oh, Pia's gone. I wonder if she's gone already. Anyway. Oh, there she is. Okay. The nucleus in both of those bottom pictures is much bigger, isn't it? And some of it's being pulled in a direction it doesn't really want to be pulled in. And that is perhaps the origin of these thoughts, that we can have an upbringing where we're being told to go and train as a doctor, but really we want to be an artist.
Yes.
And so that's what we're really talking about here, is how people can be, they don't even realize it. They might appreciate the education they've had, but actually it's not their authentic selves.
Mm.
So that's really a sort of illustration. That's all I want to say about it, because if I start going into Luther's theory, I can't understand it. But
I struggle with this. I don't know much about it at all. If you have got more notes, Jane, I'd love to see them.
I could dig them out and scan them, it'll be Luther's writing and see what you make of it. I just found it very difficult. And then actually somebody put this onto one page and I thought, actually, that's better. We're just looking at it graphically, and it's quite powerful in its way. And then the more that we can have the concept that people who are learning autogenics are probably, hopefully, going to gradually move up to something nearer to this, then something quite powerful is going on. I will do that. I will see what I can dig out.
Thank you.
Okay. I was always the one who got lumbered with doing that lecture, and I could never really quite get it together so it was coherent. The other thing is the autogenic exercise and its stages. And this is quite simple. Luther brought this into our attention. And we might, I'm just digging out the notes now, we can just run through it ever so quickly. I'll just ask you a question, though. When you adopt the posture, when does that happen when you're going to do an autogenic training session? You adopt the posture right at the start. Yes? Yeah. Yes? Yeah. And as you do that, what do you think happens? Almost like, oh, I'm doing this now. And so Luther gave it, he loved labeling things, the R stage, the reflective reactivity stage. So as soon as you adopt an autogenic posture, it's almost as though, ah, I'm changing gear now, I'm doing this. And it's a kind of reflective, he gave it the R words, reflective reactivity. Then, of course, we're into the exercise, the PC stage, the passive concentration stage. Mm-hmm. So we're actually doing the practice. And after that, where does this happen? The passive acceptance stage. I'm thinking it's got to happen before the close, but it could be after the close as well. And we're just sitting quietly for a few moments before we get up and do the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. The passive acceptance stage is quite important. It's saying, well, it's okay. We're here. We're doing this. What did I feel? Oh, that's interesting. So we're casual. We're nonchalant. And we're not trying to analyze, unless, of course, some kind of analysis comes to you. Then that's different. So passive acceptance really goes for anyone. And I'm turning over the page quickly because we all want lunch. Okay. And over the page comes the neutral stage. So this is, again, actually, we haven't closed. We haven't closed at this point. We're still perhaps in the autogenic exercise, maybe still using the formulae, or maybe we've come to a resting kind of place. So we've got passive acceptance. And he called this the stage of functional neutrality. So passive concentration has ended on the formulae. The mental activity is quiet. And in his words, it's kind of suspended between engagement in brain-directed and trainee-directed mental elaborations. However, there is also a comfortable no-thought reverie type of awareness. It's not sleep. The neutral stage or the no thought phase. Actually, that very often happens when I'm doing an exercise, I've closed my eyes, everything is all nice, I'm here, quite comfortable doing the formulae. And then I'm doing my autogenics. Oh, where did I get to? Where was I? Oh, I was in the breathing, was I? Has that happened to any of you?
Yes.
Okay.
You've talked to clients, actually.
Of course. And it's very important to explain that one to the client. You needn't worry with the rest of it necessarily. But it is important to ask them that question, especially near the end of the course, because it's a very good place they've gone into. It is the neutral phase. It's what Schultz used to call the no-thought phase. And it's where nothing is going on. Nothing at all. And of course, because nothing at all is going on, we don't even realize that's where we are. Mm. Because as soon as we realize that's where we are, there is something going on. So it really is a nothingness. But our clients are very often a little bit unnerved. They think, oh, I've lost the concentration. I'm not doing it properly. I must be. So as long as we explain this to them, they'll be fine. And they've been into a place where actually an awful lot of substantial unconscious work has been going on, which doesn't have words, it doesn't have explanations, it's just neutral. So that's where it is. And I'm a little bit confused now because the stage before that, the number three, the passive acceptance, we are still with it at that stage.
Moment of reflection.
And the neutral stage is where there really is nothing. And of course, when we come to doing personal affirmations, which we will mention, I think that's tomorrow, The neutral stage, once we realize we've just come out of it, it's a good place to put your personal formula. But we don't always have it. We shouldn't go in search of it, because that's not no thought. You'll never find it if you go looking for it. And that ties in with what you were saying, Sebastian, earlier about the breathing. The more you focus, something else, we start trying too hard and all of that. So this ties in with that, doesn't it? This neutral stage, when it really does have nothing, and you cannot go hunting for it. You can't look for it.
And Jane, that's very much the AT stage, isn't it? The state of AT.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I mean, it has to be. I think what Luther was trying to do was sort of tease out a little more formulation about it. Right. But you're quite right. Just going in and doing your autogenic exercise, your autogenic is it. It is what we're doing. But that neutral is really when there's nothing. We come to after something.
That's so what they call in Buddhism, they call it the big mind. Universal mind where there is nothing.
Interesting. Where there is nothing.
There is just bliss. It's just such a beautiful state to be in. Yeah.
But of course, the other thing about it is that because there is nothing, we might not even be aware of it until we just lift out of it. So I usually say, if we've just lifted out a little tiny bit, we can just rest in that sort of edgy bit, perhaps, and experience it. Absolutely.
Wonderful.
So that's just a little bit maybe to take us into lunch. And then the final bit, of course, is when you have closed and it is time, or you're just about to close. The exercise is ended. You have come back from your neutral stage or wherever you've been. And we're doing our close as well and coming out, readjusting to the normal world, normal tensions, etc. Normal hunger. Telling you to go and get some lunch. Okay. We have now reached a point which is on the timetable is at 2:30, and we did quite a lot on the dream formula earlier. So actually, I think we've got to a stage where, here, if we lose you from this point, you won't have missed anything, because the notes on getting started are very, very simple. And if we've got any questions, of course, we can pick them up tomorrow.
I think something has happened because I dropped out a couple of times. So I think something is going
Yes. We wondered if you'd gone just now and then you were back.
Then I was back. So I think they've started to gear up for it.
It's going to be happening any time, isn't it? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. No, look, it's good that the work is being done, you know. It's obviously that there we are. Yeah. Okay.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. We will absolutely see you tomorrow. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Take care, Pia.
Okay, Pia.
See you.
Yes, go and have some sleep. For the rest